นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังนะมัสสามิ
As you know, I've been taking some time off the last few days to continue writing about Ajahn Chah, and currently writing about analyzing his personality and character, and it's somewhat of a paradoxical kind of subject, in that the very reason why it seems worthwhile to write about Ajahn Chah is because I believe that he transcended any identification with personality. And the relationship between enlightenment and personality, and enlightenment and character traits, is all the same, a fascinating one. And Ajahn Chah's favorite simile with regards to this subject was of a number of different species of birds, different sizes of head and wingspan, different colors, different different songs, but all recognizably members of the bird family. And, he says that's the way it is with enlightened beings, that they have many distinguishing characteristics, or what we might call personality traits, but they're all recognizably members of the Aryapugala family. But having been brought up in societies which exalt the individual and tend to give great importance to personality, then it's this is carried over into spiritual life, and whether in regards to our response to great teachers, or in terms of our understanding of what we're doing and why we're practicing, and perhaps often feeling that spiritual practices should result in some radical change and improvement in personality, and looking for that as some kind of refuge. But as I mentioned a few minutes ago, the point is not to be developing a new personality, a new spiritual being, according to perhaps particular ideas of what that might be, but to understand the nature of personality as a conditioned phenomena, just being able to see these different personality traits and habits for what they are. Indeed, in fact, there is some change in personality as one practices, in that those personality traits which are founded on unwholesome dhammas will tend to wane, but personality traits which are founded on neutral or wholesome dhammas will not necessarily, and will probably not. But the the point that I would like to bring up this evening is where do we look for our support, our refuge, our strength in practice and in monastic life, looking for it in the personality and in our personality traits is obviously a dead end. So where can we look for this kind of sustenance, something which will enable us to live this life despite or irrespective of, independently of the daily vicissitudes or ups and downs of our meditation practice or our relations with those around us. And the Buddha gave a number of teachings on this very subject. And one of the first virtues or qualities that he would always bring up in this regard is sila, or our virtue. And these the sincere commitment to keeping precepts and to following the rules and regulations of the monastic community in a very even and continual way is something which gives us a sense of self-respect and self-esteem. And if we are skillful, we can bring up various aspects of our sila as a way of uplifting the mind, as in the silanusati meditations, the recollection on sila. So we, even if we have minor lapses sometimes, and even stream entrers have minor lapses in the veneer on occasion, then looking on the in the larger picture, there's an awful lot to take joy in and to be proud of. And we may start as bhikkhus just going through the heavier rules in the vinaya, in the patimokkha, the parajika rules, the sanghadisesa rules, the tulachayas, the pajitiyas, and going through each one, realizing today and for every single day since you've been a monk, you have refrained from committing any of the prajika offences. That's not an easy thing to do. It's something that's worthy a great deal of pride, wholesome pride, not arrogant pride. With the sanghadisesa rules as well, even if you have committed sanghadisesa offences before, it's probably very on extremely rare occasions, and that for time after time after time, hundreds of times probably in your monastic career, you've overcome the desire to commit such an offence. If we're to compare the number of times that you've overcome such desires and the number of times you've succumbed, number of times you've overcome desire was just outnumber the times you've succumbed is a huge degree. And this is a way of giving ourselves a sense of solidity, groundedness, and refuge in the holy life. Observing the commitment, the sincerity with which we have overall try to keep the rules of our discipline. As I say, the tendency for us is to is to go to one extreme or the other. If we're in a very heedless state of mind, it does happen, then we may very reckless about rules on some occasions. But in general, it's much more likely that we go to the other extreme and take blemishes and unwholesome actions and occasions on which we've broken vinaya rules and made a great deal out of them, much more out of it than we need to. And of course the absolutely classic wrong step is to attach these to an idea of self and to create ideas of being bad falling into the whole abyss of guilt and self-hatred. So keeping precepts skillfully and using the recollection of our sila is a very skillful means and one which gives rise to joy and contentment in the holy life. And as they say, it's a very basic, fundamental and solid way of creating self-respect and self-esteem. A second virtue which the Buddha referred to on many occasions is that of developing a good intellectual grasp of the teachings and listening to Dhamma a lot, reading at the right time, reading not just as an escape from yourself or out of boredom or restlessness, but in a measured and deliberate way, gathering a knowledge of the Theravada Buddhist teachings, particularly as represented in the Pali Canon, in the English translation, most of us, and the teachings of our masters of our own tradition, and to really immerse ourselves in those teachings so that we learn how to think and to examine our experience able to use the concepts and tools that the Buddha gave us. The more we ground ourselves in the Buddha's teachings, the more we gradually replace our old worldly habits of thought and means of interpretation. And the more we study, and certainly this is my experience, the more I study, the clearer I understand the Buddha's teaching, the more faith and confidence I have in them, in over 20 years of study of Buddha's teachings, I've yet to find a single teaching which I've been able to prove in my own experience to be wrong or mistaken. So that gives me a great deal, a sense of solidity and refuge in my practice. And if we're too eclectic and we read a bit of this and a bit of that and taking the kind of the momentary inspiration and the high of reading something new and profound as our guide in reading, then we'll flit from this to that and never really develop any kind of systematic basis for practice. So a lot of these teachings, when we first come across them, they can be a little bit kind of bland and dull, but you have to really allow yourself to go into it very patiently, and the effects of it really becomes visible. The beauty of the teachings, integrity of the teachings becomes clearer and clearer. So the more you study, the clearer you understand, the fewer the fuzzy points, the fewer the grey areas, the more confidence, the more sense of refuge and contentment that you feel in the holy life. Another point and one which is summed up by this famous saying in which Venerable Ananda says to the Buddha, Kalyana Mitata, good friendship, good friends, is half the holy life, and the Buddha rebukes him, says, no, Ananda, it's the whole of the holy life. The third quality is that of good friends, having good friends, people living with people who share the same aims, aspirations, following the same path, and those who are able to give advice, give counsel, give warmth, emotional support, give time, living in a community of like-minded beings is a wonderful gift, which when sometimes we find minor differences in view and understanding, we can perhaps overlook the underlying unity of view and approach that that we do have in such a community as ours. And this is a strength that we have. I've been in the many years that I've been in Thailand, and I've seen so many Westerners come and ordain and disrobe in other traditions where they've found themselves very conducive environments for formal practice, where they don't have to be caught up in any distractions. There are no demands made upon them. Everything is set up for them to practice, and they tend to develop, many of them develop a good formal practice. But if they don't go a little bit cranky, which is the usual danger with spending a lot of time by yourself when you're still very very new, then the other thing is that they can't bear with the downs. When you're by yourself, the ups are higher than the ups in a community usually, but the downs are much deeper. They're Bermuda Triangle kind of depths, which few people can really survive. Living in a community enables you to bear with a lot that by yourself either you would not be able to bear with, or else you'd find a good reason, a very rational reason, not to bear with. So having good friends, having some of them some of them bring to your eyes, some of them bringing tears of pain and anger, but the constant feedback that you get in a community such as this is definitely something which is strengthening you and giving you a very firm support and foundation for your efforts in the holy life. So this is something to reflect on and to be grateful for. Your friends and Kalyana Mitta and teachers, elders in the holy life, but also at the same time to be constantly aspiring towards being a good friend and a Kalyana Mitta to those around you. This not necessarily, of course, meaning giving Dhamma Desanas and profound teachings, but being one whose relations to those around you are based on metta and karuna, mudita, acts, both in public and in private, inside my metta, speech, both situations in private and situations guided by speech and mind, is being informed by the Brahma Viharas, and being one who is seeking to be a good friend, and whose contacts with others are in such a way that people around you benefit from them. They are not leading them astray, not acting, behaving, speaking in ways which add to or increase their defilements, but ways in which support and encourage their good qualities. So this is another refuge that we have, a support, and the support of having good friends, and the support of being a good friend and striving to be a good friend. Connected with that is another virtuous, now as being an auspicious virtue, and that's that sowa chasata, one of being monish, one who's meek and humbly willing to listen to other people, even if you don't always agree, being able to open up to criticism. That is a difficult one for many of us. It's easy often to be easily admonishable by the abbot and the very senior monks, or those who are quite a distance above us and he rungs up the hierarchy. But those around us who are more or less the same seniority, is quite hard to listen to admonition sometimes. There can be an element of competition that sneaks into our minds. Or perhaps we pay lip service to this virtue, but our whole manner, our words of invitation, the extent that the attempts to speak to us, although we've made the invitation, our friends don't really feel that it's sincere. So it's not just a matter of inviting others to admonish us, but really being open to criticism. And this is a way of gauging our advance in practice and in the holy life. And this is something that we may observe, that our ability to take criticism, to deal with blame, is much better than it was a year ago or 2 years ago. And again, this is something which is brings a real sense of joy to the mind. When we see that there are many areas of our lives, perhaps not the really dramatic spheres of jhana practice or jhanas or jnanas and jnanas, but just in these areas which we may overlook, how much easier we get over things when we get upset or we get completely lost in it for days at a time, but feel that we have an ability just to pull us back up again that we didn't have before. And it's important to pick up on and to notice these successes and these improvements in our life, because they're there for all of us, but sometimes we're so intent on picking at our faults and failures that we devalue these advances and successes, which are every bit as valid as the lapses and failures, and in fact indicate a trend and a gradual growth, which is very beautiful to see. Another quality which the Buddha spoke about in many occasions in Sangha life, and one which we do talk about quite a lot, and that is the interest in helping out, and in our Sangha then formalized to a certain extent in that we have officers of the Sangha, monks who perform duties for the community on a regular basis. For instance, Tanjirat is the secretary, and he's in the office every day doing various kinds of administration work, and Jitukuto is the storeman, and Siripanyo is the workmaster, and so on and so forth. So a lot of members of our community give up a lot of their personal time for the community at large, and this is a very meritorious activity, and you see that the amount of hours that some monks give to this, the time that Seitan Sukhito spends with the guests and welcoming them and giving them preliminary instruction and answering their doubts and so on. There's so many members of our community do this, and to recognize that and develop sense of dharana of it, also for each of us who and it's a strength, isn't it? Something to, and to say, well, that's solid, you know, we'll come given a lot in this particular sphere. It's something which sustains us in the holy life, and something to say to be very proud of. And finding ways, quiet little ways of helping out, and particularly the secret goodness, the small, unobtrusive little tasks that, you know, nobody is these little holes where nobody actually has specific responsibility, and things that have fallen through the net, and it's not my job, but you know, just to take them up and do them anyway. You don't have to let anybody else know. There's a wonderful feeling that comes from that, just this kind of secret helping, being someone who's looking out, being observant, and it's a kind of a lubricant to the movements of the whole community, and it adds warmth and cohesion. And making that your practice, and as your own, is something very conducive to growth and development in the holy life. Another virtue, meditative virtues now, is that of effort, putting forth effort. Now the amount of the results that we see in practice are of course going to vary from person to person, and it may well be that many of us will not, or most of us will not, reach the end of the path, and the highest fruits of the holy life. But we don't know that. We don't know our capacity and how much old karma that we may have to plow through. But we all have, and that is the capacity to put forth. You know, we may all have varying kind of problems and difficulties. Like the Buddha even called it a dhatu. Forth effort, and the effort that the Buddha spoke of usually divided into these four kinds of effort, as you know, whether you're in whatever posture you are, whether you're in a meditation hall or you're at your kuti or you're in the sala or whatever, we always have at every single moment the opportunity to put forth this kind of effort to care for the mind and to prevent unwholesome dhammas from occupying it, from subjugating it. We have the effort when we do see that some worldly thoughts or angry thoughts or cruel thoughts arise in the mind, then we can work with that. We have put mind of that burden of unwholesome thought and wholesome, beautiful states avert in the past. As human beings, we do have that potential. Esoteric, it's just a matter of putting forth the effort. And the wholesome state have arisen, we can develop even further. This is one of the reasons why human birth is considered so wonderful. This is what distinguishes us from the being of other realms, and that we can put forward this kind of effort. We can protect the mind from unwholesome states. We can abandon unwholesome states that have arisen. We can bring forth, we can nurture, create goodness and virtue, and we can develop it and bring it to maturity and fruition. And seeing this and putting forth effort, just as, again, Ajahn says, just as you having planted the water it, you look after the tree and whether the fruits are sweet or bitter of nature, your business is doing what you can do to look after strength and self-respect and support. And yes, I've got days it's not so good, but I've really put forth some effort. I need to try. When my mind gets clouded and gets resentful, angry, jealous, or whatever, you know, I try. I get out on the Jhonkrom path. I really don't indulge in it. I put forth effort, and I really find these wholesome dhammas that the Buddha, about our teachers talk about. Try to bring them up in my mind. When I see them, I look after them, care for them, develop them. This is something which gives us a refuge in our life. In the sense that, if something's happening here, we're doing something which we can be proud of, and something which is leading onwards. This is something which leads onwards. As bhikkhus, we learn, given the food that we're offered, this medical treatment which is offered to us, and if we gratitude, contentment, in its good robes, it would be a bit nicer if it was like this or like that. Maybe our robes are too heavy or our robes are too light or our bowl's too big, our bowl's too small. Our kuti's a bit hot during the day, or I'd like a kuti or a smaller kuti or a shadier kuti or one with a bit more air coming, or this or that. There's always, the grass is always greener and there's always some way that things could have, but if we allow our minds to just to follow, it's not the way to peace, is it? And the way of the samana. The samana is one is anything's it's fine. I can live with and do this. I can it's not important to me, it's not central to me. If I get a kuti which I like, that's great. If there's nice food, that's all right. If it's not nice food, that's okay. Plain food. If we're wise, we can have simplicity and peace. The bhajaisi, the four requisites, these are the four supports in themselves. They're supports for us to lead the holy life. That's all. And certainly in this monastery, good enough for the purpose. This is something which, you know, when we're at peace, material world, and we're at peace with the record we make, and we're not getting this kind of ambition and restlessness, bigger and better and more. this is something is very conducive to our life and our practice. Going on to mindfulness, this and the Buddha's phrase, mindfulness is necessary, just as the Prime Minister has to keep an eye out on every government, so mindfulness, as every breath, just as salt is present in every dish, at least in mindfulness is necessary in every, it's making mindfulness your goal, looking away from and seeing that the Buddha said that there's heedlessness is the evil, in the sort of a free translation. There's nothing that can't go wrong. There's nothing if you lose mindfulness. Mindfulness is your refuge. Truly, when you're mindful, you're clear, present, you're awake, then aware of what's right, what's wrong, what's appropriate, what's inappropriate, said, what shouldn't be said. Everything is mindfulness is there, and nothing's there when mindfulness is not. That's why Ajahn Chah says, you know, a moment without mindfulness is a moment of madness, a moment of craziness. Words, of course, it's a moment of death. Sati, mindfulness, is what gives you life, what gives your meaning, your life. So really caring for mindfulness and adapting, be mindful of your breathing at every single moment of the day. Social interaction, you can't be mindful of your breath the whole time. You can be mindful of your speech. It's an occasion to develop, moving about, being in your body, to be mindful of the movements of moving forwards, moving back, turning left, turning right, bending, standing, putting on your robe, taking off your robe, urinating, eating, drinking, sit up, putting your cup on the floor, taking it off again, and so on. These are ways to be mindful. And there's this sense of solidity when you can just be in the present moment with what you're doing. And can you see the most basic kind of things that you do? Being and walking and just ordinary mundane activities in your life. Just sweeping your kuti. If you give respect and interest in what's not important and creating that kind of duality in your life, but it's a moment of good karma, and one which is leading dhara. It's leading towards the deathless. So whether it's the mindfulness is the act of urination, or whether the object of mindfulness is the refined breath, the moment of mindfulness is refuge, leading you onwards to the deathless. And finally, the virtue which the Buddha saying, in fact, it is the defining virtue of Buddhism, and that's wisdom. And wisdom coming from listening, attention, memorizing, going over and over in your mind, developing this reflective state, this interest in your life, interest in what it means to be a human being, reflecting, learning ways of looking at things which help you to let go. And this is bound up with this, we say, lust for Dhamma, even. It's karma. It's this great passion for Dhamma. Someone who has refuge in this life. It's a passionate. The Buddha at one point, giving monks some kind of guidance, how you're actually a sotapanna, if you're a stream enterer. And the things he says, he advises monks to your attitude to Dhamma teachings. He said, do you really... you're really keen, even now, as a stream entry, do you listen to the Dhamma? Do you feel uplifted and inspired by the Dhamma? This is a sign of that you have Dhamma, that you still love it, that you have this passion, compassion for Dhamma. And we can see this in our great teacher, Chah, Siddhaja Mahabhua, see these monks that sometimes they start talking and just suddenly they fill up and their voice gets loud. The act of expressing the Dhamma through their mind is any other activity, because their health is so the Dhamma which and truth and the teachings which absolutely shines from them. This love of Dhamma arm is something which would strengthen and support you in this life. And this use of to let go, learning how to let go, to see, investigate phenomena, being able, if the mind's very lustful, being able to defects, the drawbacks, the unpleasant side of things when the mind, being able to just to tip it over and see the and beautiful, noble aspects, findings to deal with desires and cravings and skillful means of dealing with anger and negativity, dealing with confusion and fear, and most importantly, using this faculty we have, change, instability, the flat perceptions, our thoughts, our ideas. Yeah, that's who I am, that's me, that's it. It's just moving and moving and moving. Nothing there, that's the independent self-existent entity standing behind it, the doer, the feeler, the one who acts or is acted upon. Come. I just see this movement, using to observe, not just adopting some kind of life, but saying, is there anything permanent there? Is which gives some lasting satisfaction? Is there anything that's worthy of being called self? This is the one, and this is ultimately what leads to liberation. Good evening. I would just like to share these a few reflections on qualities that we can draw upon in our faith and support our practice. Yeah.